view the ecosystems. Perhaps you could compare and contrast, Gary Ferguson, the you know, what the stand maintenance, the older type fires did with the ecosystem, positive interaction there versus the mega fires. They're, you know, I'm recalling the big Yellowstone fires of 1988, and it was just incredible to look at all that charred land. But the, you know, the growth has come back. Are there differences?
Yeah, you know, that was by any definition a mega fire season in Greater Yellowstone, and yet the fire was not burning hot enough to sterilize the soil. So the revegetation that came back beginning almost immediately in that fall, and certainly by the following spring, there were large full pine seedlings sprouting at the rate of 100,000 seedlings an acre. So it really got with the program, and it cleared away a lot of that fuel load. So that's the good news, and mega fires will accomplish that. Some of the things to be aware of, though, if the fire gets too hot and burns too fast and too often, and that's happening certainly in parts of the Southwest, you can actually, one, I mentioned sterilize the soil. That can happen, and that greatly slows down the ability of the plants to regenerate in the wake of the fire. And what that also does is to destabilize the soil. If you combine the lack of plants because sterilized soil and the fact that super hot fires do something to the soil called making it hydrophobic, it basically is vaporizes the plants, and there's almost a silicone-like mist that falls down onto the earth, and water will not soak in, then you have the potential for massive debris slides that can wipe out entire communities and have caused no end of destruction, especially in Southern California. So that's a difference with the mega fires. The other thing is they're seeing in certain parts of New Mexico and Arizona, these fires burning hot and frequently enough that the old forest, if you will, just can't regenerate any longer, in part because of the fire, in part because of the drought conditions are making it so that those trees don't do so well. So what were forests once are now becoming grasslands and shrublands. So we could see a significant portion of the Southwest go out of forest into grass and shrubland. And that's, you know, not the end of the world, but it is problematic for the commercial value of the forest, for the ability of the forest to capture and store water. By the way, that effect alone in our forests in America is now valued at about $4 trillion a year. So there are some consequences from losing those forests.
So we've sort of gotten into this. I want to maybe go here now. You have a chapter on it titled Future Fire. What are the experts telling us we can expect?
Well, one thing that your listeners may not be aware of is the Forest Service, as the primary still firefighting federal agency, has to spend its own budget in severe fire years. And that is a staggering amount of money. In one fire alone in eastern Colorado a couple years back, they spent $240 million in 2 weeks. Again, threatening a lot of structures, so there's no choice. You have to get in there and do it. But unlike, say, FEMA funds that are made available when natural disasters occur, hurricanes or floods or things like that, Forest Service has no access to that kind of money. There's a bill sitting in the House of Representatives, H.R. 167, that's been sitting there for 2.5 years that would change that would give them some money so that they could use general funds to fight fires in severe seasons. And what that would do would be to free up some of the rest of their budget to suppress prevention, such as thinning and prescribed burning, so making the forest less flammable, so mega fires are harder to start. And it would also free up some money for education, helping communities do these kinds of prevention techniques that we were talking about earlier. But as it stands now, they just are really draining their budget. It's up to over 60% now that goes to firefighting, and it's expected to be about 75% in the next 10 years. So we need to change that funding so we can get to those prevention programs and we can get to the treatment programs that we were talking about.
Yeah, that does. And I that kind of makes you depressed, right, when you think about having to depend on Congress to act. But
I know. Yeah, I know. It's a long wait. It's a long wait sometimes.
Yeah.
That's true.
On that depressing note, we'll end this segment. We'll take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about maybe some things that can be done. Inject some hope here. Some interesting findings or potential findings coming out of the Missoula Fire Lab, for example. I want to talk a bit about that. And you take a look at how these fires are fought. It is a heroic band of people who do the firefighting. We'll talk about those and other things. The book is Land on Fire, The New Reality of Wildfire in the West. Gary Ferguson is the author. You can join this conversation. As Veronica did, she called 800-826-1495. You can as well toll-free 800-826-1495. Love to get your experience, your worries, your thoughts on wildfires in the West. You can email us as well to upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com. More following this break.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the Cache Valley Visitors Bureau, presenting the Cache Valley Foodie Trek, access to the National Forest, and live theater opportunities. More information available online at explorelogan.com. And the USU Lyric Repertory Company's 50th Golden Anniversary Bash, July 21st and 22nd, an evening of celebration including a reception with past and present company members, music, food, and a light show. Details at lyricrep.org.
Next time on Ask Me Another, we talk to Daily Show correspondent Roy Wood Jr. about his favorite relaxation technique, jigsaw puzzles.
Buffalo Games is killing the city skylines.
All right.
We got Seattle, Chicago, New York, the Albuquerque Hot Air Balloon Festival.
Are you kidding me? So join me, Ophira Eisenberg, for NPR's Hour of Puzzles, Word Games, and Trivia.
Join us Saturday morning at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. With wildfires raging in Utah and other areas, we're turning to writer Gary Ferguson for a timely discussion about wildfires on the program today. His book is Land on Fire, The New Reality of Wildfire in the West. You're welcome to join this conversation at 800-826-1495, 800-826-1495, or you can email us to upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com. We have about 12 minutes left in our discussion today. So, Gary Ferguson, you have talked to some scientists. You looked at some of the latest technology. There are some hopeful things we can point to. For example, early detection. There are some efforts going on there.
Yes, we do live happily in an age of astonishingly effective technology that's getting better all the time. So, for instance, the Goddard Space Center division of NASA tends to take satellite imagery of the United States on a very regular basis. Now they've got thermal imaging capacity, which means they can basically see from space which forests in the United States are especially plagued by drought and dry conditions. They can even determine to some extent moisture levels. And so what happens from those images, and we're talking about images that are shot way back in February, March, and April, there is some intelligence applied to staging resources. There are basically 15 giant federal fire caches around the country, and depending on which region looks like it may be the most likely to burn and burn severely, we can stage those resources so that the response can be as quick as possible. There are also lots and lots of apps coming online that firefighters can use in the field with a small laptop or even their cell phone that can give them real-time weather conditions right where they are on the fire. We have, in Utah, you have a number, actually a couple hundred of these what are called remote weather stations, and those are powered by solar power, and they feed real-time information about the fuel moisture content and wind speed and precipitation and all kinds of things that help firefighters on the ground figure out the safest way to fight the fire. So these applications are extremely effective, and they allow the one important thing, and that's to get on fires as quickly as possible when they're in an area that contain excessive fuel loads and the weather conditions are such that you just cannot let them burn. These kinds of technologies help us get ahead of the fire. It's worth noting that out of 100,000 burns that hit the United States every year, all but about 3% are put out by firefighters before they reach 10 acres. So our firefighters are doing a pretty magnificent job.
One of the things coming out of the Missoula Fire Lab, I learned there was a Missoula Fire Lab from your book, but low-intensity fires may increase resistance to the bark beetle infestation.
Yes, that's a very significant thing, because these low-intensity fires, or what we called earlier stand maintenance fires, can actually eliminate pine bark beetles and other types of beetles, spruce budworm and so forth, in a forest, and keep them from spreading to the next forest. And that pine bark beetle has become an amazingly significant force in the Intermountain West right now. The trees have been so stressed by drought that they're much more vulnerable to insect infestation than they would be if they were healthy. Lodgepole pines, which I know you have in Utah, you'll sometimes see them with little nodules of sap all over their bark, and that's really from the tree pitching out, literally with pitch, insect infestations. Well, in drought conditions, you can't really do that. So the tree's too stressed, not enough moisture in it. But yeah, these fires would come through and limit, not eliminate, but limit beetle infestations, and that's a really important aspect of those low grade stand maintenance fires.
So with increased mega fires, with the stand maintenance fires, is that increasingly going to have to be prescribed burns then?
Yes, I think it absolutely will. And, you know, back to our technology discussions, that's one of the things that the Missoula Fire Sciences Laboratory has developed in the last couple of years, is a very accurate wind predictor, direction and speed predictor, so that if a land management agency, a state or a federal government wants to go in and do a prescribed burn in an area that has a heavy fuel load, they can use these applications to determine what day or a couple of days is going to be best as far as not letting the fire get out of control, but also just so that it's the direction of the wind isn't such that it's pouring smoke into a nearby community, which people don't like much at all. So it's becoming a more and more precise kind of work, and it's absolutely necessary. We're going to have to do prescribed burns. It's tough, though, Tom, to be honest, because I'm calling you from Oregon right now, and we have about 500,000 acres that need that kind of treatment. And we're managing to do about 5,000 acres a year so far, and it has to be done sometimes every 10 or 15 years. So if you do the math, you can realize that it's tough to get on top of it at that rate.
Also, politically, tougher and tougher. People in nearby communities are leery of prescribed burns.
Yes, they really are. Again, because, one, they fear that if they get out of control, their homes could be compromised, and two is smoke. People just are not particularly fond of breathing smoke, and that's why these apps that allow more precise burning at just the right times are coming online at exactly the right time. But you're right, there is some resistance in the communities, but we really, one way or another, we have to get rid of those excessive fuel loads. So it's either going to be through burning intentionally, or it's going to be through fires coming and perhaps being mega fires without us having much to say about it. Those are our two choices at this point.
Let's see. We have this from Charles Ashurst. He emailed us. You can as well. upraccess@gmail.com. He says, could logging replace prescribed burns for controlling undergrowth?
Yes, a wonderful question. What logging can do, not so much as a remedy for excessive fuel load, but for thinning. A lot of forests have, for a variety of reasons, grown up with clusters and clumps of young trees that are very flammable. They don't represent the traditional forests that we would have seen hundreds of years ago, and they're much more prone to fire, especially in climate change. Logging can be very useful as a thinning tool. One of the things that has kept it a little bit off the charts so far is that a lot of those young trees are small dimensional timber, And so what I'm seeing in Montana and Oregon, and I'm sure it will happen elsewhere, is retrofitting of logging mills so that it can handle the small dimensional timber, at the same time creating uses and markets for that small dimensional timber. And here in Oregon and also Montana, they're using it for what's called cross-laminate building. And it's a technique where you use small dimensional timber and you put it with a variety of fireproof resins, and you actually make structures out of wood. I'm probably six blocks now from an eight-story structure that's going to be entirely wood and very fireproof. So if we can create these markets, that's a wonderful thing, because it helps pay for the cost of the thinning that makes the forest healthier, and that's an ideal thing. Again, you don't necessarily have the option, though, of doing this in remote areas where there aren't roads. If you helicopter logged, it would be far too expensive to make any sense at all. But in some areas, this kind of commercial timbering activity will in fact be a good thing.
I want to read a quote. This is page 188, to have you expand on this. You're right. Whether we're trying to, this illustrates problems of management, the complexity of this. Whether we're trying to reduce fuel loads in the big woods of the West, stopping destructive invasions of non-native plants, maintaining wildlife diversity, or controlling wildfire-related erosion and landslides, we'll need to marry the most rigorous science we can muster with a kind of genuine humility and commitment that until now has been too often in short supply.
Yes, I do stand by that paragraph. You know, we really do, Tom, have all the intelligence we need. We understand what's going on, the natural processes, and somewhat, you might argue, unnatural processes from climate change and leading to these megafires. We understand what needs to be done. We simply have to muster the heart and the will to do it. And some of that activity is going to be working with our county commissioners to get the help they need to design more firewise communities. You know, they have wonderful tools that they may not even know about. There's a group called Headwaters Economics in Bozeman, Montana, that offers incredible instruction to county commissioners all over the United States about how to create more firewise communities. We're going to have to get with our neighbors if we live in the wildland-urban interface and do what Colorado does, and that's something called saws and slaws, where everybody gets out and thins the forest with some help from the local fire department or land management agency, and then they have burgers and beer that night, and it's a way to bring people together to create a healthier forest around their communities. So we really have everything we need, all the expertise. It's just time to get serious, because if we don't, this fire is not going to go away. It's going to be with us, and it can be either something we can tolerate or something we're just thoroughly overwhelmed and devastated by. It's up to us.
We have a caller, Jessica in Logan. Jessica, glad you called. Go ahead with your question or comment.
And you've been covering a little bit of this, but I just received within the past couple of days an email from Mr. Mike Lee talking about the big fire that we've just had down in Bryan Head, and he's taken it as an opportunity to blame it on the bunny huggers for stepping in and not allowing the right kind of maintenance, and, of course, using that as a catalyst to push for more logging and more grazing. And while I understand the importance of that kind of management, what's the healthy median to aim for or explain to our extractive-oriented representatives?
Thanks, Jessica. We'll get a response from Gary Ferguson. Then I have an email. Go ahead, Mr. Ferguson.
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. And the fact of the matter is, as I was saying just a little bit ago, there are some places where commercial timbering of small dimensional lumber makes sense. It makes sense where there are road networks already established, and certainly we have a lot of that kind of country in the West. When you get into very steep terrain, remote areas, wilderness, it makes no sense to claim that commercial timbering is going to save the day, because, as a matter of fact, yes, it does go, against the values of a lot of people who want to have unencumbered land, but it's also simply not economically viable to go in and either build road systems that are tax subsidized or to use helicopters, which is an extraordinarily expensive proposition. So we can use commercial timbering, and it probably should increase in some areas, especially once we get that commercial infrastructure in place, but it's not even close close to what we need to pay attention to as far as these other treatments like prescribed burning and letting fires burn in wildland areas where no structures are threatened.
Thanks for that, Jessica. Appreciate that perspective. And I've heard some of those comments coming out of from Mike Noel as well. Here's the email from Jake. Jake says, underbrush is a large fuel source, is it not? How could we help minimize that?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. If it's natural underbrush, what happened with stand maintenance fires, they would burn the underbrush, but not necessarily be hot enough or strong enough to burn the trees that surrounded it. The other thing you'll see is if you go into the forests, and I know you have these forests in Utah of, say, ponderosa pine, you'll see that ponderosa pine don't, mature trees don't have any branches for the first 25 or 30 feet. They drop them as the tree grows. That's so that there's no ladder available, basically, for the wildfire to catch those trees and burn them. Underbrush, if it's dead or if it's overly thick, can certainly be a part of thinning and prescribed burning, which would take care of the extra density of that. If it's an invasive kind of plant, unfortunately, short of poisoning, we're just going to have to keep our prescribed burning projects going every 10 or 12 years to just try to keep a handle on those as much as we possibly can.
Just have about a minute left. I'd advertise that we talk a bit about the firefighters themselves. You have a chapter on this, so your minute version of that. There is a heroic cadre of people who fight these fires.
Well, it is amazing work, Tom. And a hotshot crew, for instance, will come on and be the first on a fire, digging a fire line to try to control it, working at a fierce pace. To put it in perspective, burning about 600 calories an hour, 7,000 calories a day to get this work done. That's one of the things that all firefighters are worried about, is us talking about these mega fires. They're bigger, they're hotter, they create their own weather, which can make the fires act in erratic fashion, create fire whirls. So their ability to use all of their knowledge, as well as to use the technology and these apps that are emerging to keep on top of what's going on in any given minute, is super important. And they're already in a very, very risky situation with their work, and it's going to only get riskier in the years to come. So they're going to be very committed to training, and I think we all owe them a big thanks, because they make it possible for those of us who live in the wildland urban interface to do so safely.
We've been talking with Gary Ferguson. His new book is Land on Fire, The New Reality of Wildfire in the West. You can find Gary Ferguson at his website, wildwords.net. Gary Ferguson, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom. It's been a pleasure.
And thanks for listening to Access Utah.
And Culligan Water of Cache Valley, family-owned and operated for more than years, providing Culligan bottled water, salt delivery, or soft and conditioned water. Hey Culligan Man, service from the man in blue, online at logan.culliganman.com.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the Logan Downtown Alliance, presenting the overall start of the 2017 Larry H. Miller Tour of Utah in downtown Logan, July 29th through 31st. Information of events, locations, and times available at Logan Downtown.
You're listening to Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU FM Logan, and also heard at upr.org.